Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
What would make you visit a war zone? For some, humanitarianism compels them to travel, putting themselves in harm's way in order to deliver supplies and medical support for those displaced by conflict. Others travel to volunteer to fight, a mood which was well documented with the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s, and which resurfaced most recently following Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In the 1810s, however, some people were traveling to the continent for a less selfless reason. Tourism. In the midst of the largest conflict Europe had seen to that point in history, some Brits decided that they wanted to go and see for themselves the conflict which would be termed the Great War until the 1914-18 conflict came along. They went to see the sights, to tour the battlefields, to marvel at the destruction, and to revel in the perceived glory of war. What they left behind, apart from perhaps some slightly disgusted locals who recoiled at their casual xenophobia, was a series of accounts giving us a snapshot of life in the Iberian Peninsula as it was racked by war. For the first time, a project is trying to piece together their recollections to offer us an insight into a previously neglected perspective on Anglo-Spanish-Portuguese relations during a conflict which, for the British at least, contains a lot of cozy assumptions about harmonious relations and mutual respect, which is a long way from the reality. Tonight, the historians behind that new project, Professor Rosemary Sweet and Dr. Richard Ansell, tell all about these voyeuristic war chasers, their motivations, their attitudes towards the Spanish and Portuguese, and their responses to the horrors of war. This is Peninsular War Tourism, Travels in Wellington's War Zone. Up next on the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Hello and welcome back to the Napoleonic Wars Pod, where, as you've heard, we're doing something. I'm not going to say it's weird, but it's not what I kind of expected when I first kind of looked into this topic. Tourism in the peninsula, but specifically when a war's going on, it's not something that you would necessarily expect, but it was very much a thing, as we're going to explore today. I am joined by two superb academics who are channeling a new furrow in our knowledge of this very odd, I'm going to settle with odd, kind of concept of hey, let's go to an active war zone and take a nice holiday. It's not really what you kind of expect, admittedly. So I am joined by Professor Rosemary Sweet, who is Professor of Urban History at the University of Leicester. She's published very widely on the history of travel, including Cities and the Grand Tour, the British in Italy, 1690-1820, that was with Cambridge, and on the reception of the past in the long 18th century and on 18th century urban culture and politics. These are all topics that I am woefully ignorant about. I need to go and do some reading. She's also a member of the Council for the British School at Rome and chairs their Faculty of Archaeology, History and Letters. So we've got, you know, an achiever in the house this morning, but she is currently working on a Leverhulme Trust-funded project entitled War, Travel and Cultural Exchange, William Gell and the British in Iberia, 1750 to 1830. But today I don't bring you one guest, but two, because I also have Dr. Richard Ansell, who's a researcher at Birkbeck, University of London, who's interested in 17th and 18th century travel. He's the author of Complete Gentlemen, Education, Travel and Family Strategy, 1650 to 1750. That was published by the British Academy in 2022. And he's also published articles and chapters on travel and its relationship with social and cultural history. He's working with Rosemary on that Leverhulme Trust research project, War, Travel and Cultural Exchange, and is also working on a project on non-elite travel from early modern England. Quite how you manage to run two research projects at once completely baffles me. I have a hard enough time just dealing with, I don't know, running this podcast and then trying to do other things. But welcome, both of you. First timers on this show as well. How are you both doing?
Fine, thank you very much.
Well,
university closed yesterday, so it's holidays.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me.
There's an indication of the commitment. These people are giving up their time during their holiday in order to record for you guys. So go and show the love. And you've heard those books, and I'll also include links in the description so that you can find out more about their really interesting research. To the meat of the episode, though, we're going to talk a lot about how the British perceive the Spanish and the Portuguese, quite why Spain and Portugal are seen as a place that you want to go to. We're going to talk about the Grand Tour and the fact that this isn't sort of necessarily, it's not on the Grand Tour in the traditional sense, and why that might be. But I'm going to be self-indulgent here and look at a question that I've been trying to wrap my head around for a long time, because there is this popular perception that, hey, look, the British love the Portuguese. They kind of don't like the Spanish so much because, you know, Trafalgar, but the enemy of my enemy is my friend. So, you know, the British go out there and they're being, oh, so benevolent, and it's all so wonderful and rosy. And the reality that I tend to remind people is that when you read the accounts of the people traveling in the British army, there's a lot of xenophobia going on. And so this lovely, fluffy picture that we have of the romanticization of the Spanish and Portuguese populations, that does happen in British popular culture in that early phase, almost immediately evaporates within the first 6 months of troops landing in Portugal and Spain, and seeing that actually the entire nation hasn't risen up, and there isn't sort of a guerrilla hiding behind every thicket of brambles or behind every low wall in Spain. And what you get is really derogatory, really scathing comments about both nationalities. The ones that immediately spring to mind, the Portuguese are described as dirty, lazy, louse-ridden. There's a lot of kind of scathing comments about the degree of the importance of religion in these people's lives, and kind of really, again, derogatory kind of comments about, you know, look at these people, what are they doing? Fashion obviously raises its head. A lot of, frankly, unsurprising misogyny. So there's a lot there to unpick. And that's a very waffly first question. So apologies, it's more a comment than a question. So let's start by unpicking this. How much consistency, is there even any consistency in the attitudes that you've seen expressed about the locals before the outbreak of the war? Let's start with pre-war and then sort of start to track it through. So prior to the outbreak of the Peninsular War, whether we're tracking that pre-revolution, because, you know, these things have got a long lead in, or during the revolution phase of the conflict, or during the Napoleonic Wars phase of the conflict, are there any kind of consistent attitudes in terms of how people talk about the locals out in the Iberian Peninsula?
Well, but yeah, there are some consistencies, obviously. I think in the 18th century, prior to the Peninsular War, people who go out to Spain are traveling with an image that is derived from, on one hand, the black legend. So this idea that Spain and Portugal are ridden with superstition, that there's a kind of innate cruelty, and that it's a very sort of repressive, illiberal society. And that's one aspect. Then there's the images of Spain that they've derived from their voracious reading of Spanish romance and the influence of Spanish drama on British drama and playwriting, starting in the 17th century but through the 18th. And that's where you get the idea of the sort of sexy Spanish females and the sort of sensual allure of Spain. That's a very common motif. And but there's also from this tradition the sense of the Spanish as being proud, as being honorable, as being courageous, and being chivalric. So we have two sort of polarities, if you like, the positive side and the negative. And Portugal is seen very much as a minor variation on the theme of Spain. No, this doesn't really have a distinct image, it's just Spain, minus some of the nobility of the Hidalgos, really. So that's what people travel out with. And they also travel with the assumption that really has been popularized by Montesquieu and Esprit de Loi, that the warm south creates this kind of indolence. And that explains why the south is more backward compared to, well, perceived as being backward compared to Western Europe. Western Europe is the hub of progress and modernity, and the South is just sitting there in the sun, being indolent and smoking their tobacco. So there are expectations of finding laziness, indolence, and this accounts for the decline of Spanish economy. And so there are a lot of preconceptions that people travel with. Once they arrive in Iberia, a lot of those obviously are confounded when they confront reality, and in particular, the comments about indolence. Yes, they do find examples of what they perceive to be laziness, but they also are very impressed by the industry, hardworking, the toughness of the particularly the Spanish peasantry, and indolence when they actually confront it. In Spain, they explain in terms of the nature of the government that it is demotivating. It's that you have no, well, private property isn't equally distributed. The nobility aren't allowed to be educated, so there's no incentive to improve. And there's because private property is amassed in the hands of nobility, there's no incentive for the peasants to work hard in order to buy their own property, etc. They can explain it in terms of the nature of government and civil society, and they're quick to acknowledge that they're not all of the Spanish peasantry, Spanish people are idle. They are hardworking, and they become much more aware of the variations within Spain, of course. So the Basque region is much more industrious. The Catalans are much more industrious. The Andalusians enjoy sitting around singing songs and talking, but they also work very hard in the vineyards, this kind of thing. And the Portuguese are generally regarded, because Portugal's inferior, seen as inferior to, subordinate to Spain, they tend to talk about Portuguese as being a worse variant, if you like, so dirtier and a bit more backward. And but that partly reflects the fact that they don't really explore much of Portugal. They go to Lisbon, and the roads are so bad they didn't go anywhere else. They just go east straight away to Badajoz and across the border into Spain. So they encounter much less of Portugal in this period than they do of Spain. And despite the fact you've got the English factory up in Oporto, very few people go there unless they're merchants. I mean, obviously the merchants do, but if you go to Lisbon for your health, as a lot of people did, you just stay put. You might go to Sintra and Mafra, but you don't say, let's have a day trip to Oporto, because it would take weeks.
Obviously, I suppose we might come on to this again, but that's something that obviously the experience of travel in the military or civilian travel during the war changes, because it's the engagement with and encounters with other parts of the peninsula that might not have been on a pre-war tourist route, as you're saying. But yeah, I think I agree. There's a very an extremely long lead-in to the attitudes towards Spain and Portugal in this during wartime travel. And as Ravi said, there's a kind of black legend of the behavior, in particular of the Spanish, but also Portuguese in the Americas and in the Netherlands, and these kind of ways in which there's like an early modern view of kind of innate aspects of national character. But that's also, as Ravi mentioned, kind of coming into contact with more of a 18th century Enlightenment view that a lot of these issues can be ascribed to government and the church. And often, as Spanish and Portuguese, and in particular Spanish writers counter, this is just a kind of reheating of the old views, just saying, well, this they're like this because of their government and their dominance by the church, but it's the same kinds of prejudiced views in some ways that are being brought to bear on the Spanish and Portuguese.
Yeah. And it's, they tend also, I mean, they tend to congregate in the cities and they meet civilize the more enlightened Spanish, the ilustrados, and so they exempt them from the sort of negative aspects of Spanish character, but they put the blame for decline in Spanish character on the elite and say the peasants are all splendid, or most of the peasants are splendid, and so it's very much blaming the ruling class for not being sufficiently enlightened, really. And so it's very much framed in terms of the extent to which Spain has participated in the sort of intellectual, social progress of enlightenment.
Yeah.
There's a curious kind of, I'm just trying to plumb the depths of sort of half-remembered ideas here. So apologies if this is absolute nonsense, but feel free to shout me down if so. But there's a sort of strange consistency with the idealization of sort of the rugged sort of working class ideal of a Brit that takes a long time, I feel, to emerge. I mean, it's a lot of my work focuses on British soldiers who are sort of regarded as something much lesser than your classic kind of member of the working class, which is of course absolute nonsense because they're laborers and all the rest of it. You know, they are very much your working class type, and yet there does seem to be sort of a kind of, I guess what I'm asking, are they transplanting ideals about what a British working class person might be, in as much as working class even exists during this point, which is obviously a whole other debate, onto other nationalities? And the part of the reason that I'm asking that is because we see that happen with race and martial race theory. So I'm wondering if there's a kind of commonality going on there.
I think rather they're using what they choose to highlight in the Spanish labourers, peasants, qualities that they wish the British labouring working class had. So they emphasise the fact that they're very abstemious and they never drink any wine, or if they do, it's watered down. Again, confrontation with specific examples and reality doesn't always bear that out, but that's the generalisation. And that they're much more friendly and courteous. So you get a lot of examples of people say, commenting on the cheerful aspect, the friendly demeanour, so unlike our surly British peasants or whatever. So they draw these unfavourable comparisons with the British working class and idealise in a way the Spanish labourers in a way which is, as much a commentary on what they perceive problems of want of social deference and excessive alcohol consumption in Britain as it is about Spain.
As so often with, I suppose, in the history of travel writing, it's often the traveller writing as much with an eye on their own country and using what they're seeing abroad to criticise what they believe of home, isn't it? And I suppose we've also seen those kinds of things not just with working people, but with women as well. And views of Spanish and Portuguese women are often contrasted with what they believe of British women in their behaviour at home.
Continuing to just rabbit hole here because I just find this fascinating. So, it's the usual story on this podcast, folks. There's a list of questions, and we haven't got to question two yet, but I don't care, because this is just interesting. I just want to pick up on what you were talking there about, sort of this ideal of what the working class might be, and where religion sits within all of that, because of course this is a deeply Catholic country, and Britain is very much not that, and is very concerned about, the implications of a resurgent Catholicism, and the impact that that might have on the inverted commas stability of the country. And, King is defender of the faith, and the arguments that happen over Catholic emancipation, more than 3 decades after the period that we're talking about. And so I'm just curious about whether religion kind of feeds into that. Is there a sort of an argument being made that, hey, look, it's great, these people are religious, it's just a shame that they're the inverted commas wrong type of religion? And is there any sort of attempt to ascribe some of these virtues to that religious inclination, or do they just kind of steer clear of that because you end up in dangerous territory of people potentially then using that as an argument for, well, maybe actually Catholicism is the way. Maybe a society structured around the Catholic mode of worship is it makes for a better society that fits the ideal of what we would like the working class to be.
I'd say no. I mean, when they talk about the religion of working classes or the labouring classes, it's largely in terms of them being the dupes and the victims of corrupt and greedy church, and so they're being milked of their wealth by the church through taxes. And so they'll comment on how richly furnished, decorated the church is, and that this is all because they've extracted so much money from the peasants, etc. And so they talk about the superstition of the peasants and complain about the muleteers insisting on saying mass before they leave every morning, this kind of thing. And they talk about the ubiquity of sort of religious prints on the walls and the fact that everybody kneels down when the hosts pass in the street. And I mean, sometimes they're quite impressed by this. That's a very powerful display of devotion, and they find it impressive, if wrong-headed. And what they're tending to say in the 18th century is that Spanish Catholicism is not a true faith. It's very mechanistic. It's not born of conviction. It's really it's well, it's a very cynical view of it. It's mechanistic, and if you like, it's a instrument for the extraction of resources rather than being driven by any sense of interior piety. And you can, well, I mean, this is kind of evangelical sentiment coming through here. What you do get, particularly by the late 18th, early 19th century, and again, I think it's born of a sense of receding danger of Catholicism, because you see this in other contexts too, is a greater willingness to be moved by the devotion of people. And so talking about seeing a service and being impressed by the devotion of the people at the service, or being impressed by the sort of sublime experience of the combination of music and environment and some of the Easter or Christmas services, for example. But they're very much repelled by things like the sort of self-flagellation that goes on in processions during Lent. They find that horrific. And they're very distasteful, the saints' relics, this kinds of things. So they don't actually ascribe much of the virtue that they see amongst the peasantry to religion at all. It's despite of rather than because of, I think. Would you agree, Richard?
I think so, yeah. I also d agree, perhaps towards the end of the period we've been looking at, maybe even kind of post-Peninsular War, there's kind of more of a comfort, maybe, as you've said, of being moved by examples of devotion. Perhaps, as in general, as travellers and readers in Britain are more willing to see have a kind of a romanticised view of Spain, they're more willing to be kind of drawn in and fascinated by kind of Catholic devotion and its strength. I was also thinking that of somebody who's worth mentioning, if we're thinking about the working class in Britain and Spanish religion, is a man called John MacDonald, who travelled to Spain in the 1770s as a servant, and he was Protestant. But he makes clear that when he was travelling within Spain, he found it easier and perhaps more interesting to live as a Catholic and to kind of attend mass and participate in local religion while he was there, but when he comes home again to resume his kind of Protestant worship. So while there's I suppose, as you might expect, in the 18th century, a lot of kind of British anti-Catholicism at play, there's also, a kind of attraction to these kinds of first of all, more of a complicated relationship, but also even with the majority of travellers, I suppose a kind of an attraction to Spanish and Portuguese Catholicism as kind of part of the tourist experience, I suppose.
I
Well,
really
and
want a deep dive.
the Inquisition becomes a tourist experience in itself. And so by the late 18th, early 19th century, you have travellers being asked to be taken to see the premises of the Inquisition, so they can feel that thrill of sort of Gothic horror and see the instruments of torture, and they get very upset if their Lady Holland was very disappointed when her guide wouldn't show her the instruments of torture, which when she was visiting the Inquisition in Valencia it was. Yes, so it's becomes a the yes the whole sort of tradition of Spanish Catholicism becomes a kind of tourist commodity to view in itself. And people like to say, oh, if you don't kneel at the Angelus, you'll be lynched by the mob. But they're not. I mean, they've there's one the Call, Lieutenant Call, George Call, he records being spat at in church for being a Protestant. But I think that's the worst example we've come across of people being threatened because of their Protestantism rather than being lynched. And people talk about confu there's confusion that Catholics assumed that anybody who wasn't a Catholic was therefore a pagan and not a Christian. But that's again that's the stereotype of sort of Spanish insularity being brought up there, that they don't know anything about anywhere outside Spain.
So it
And
turns
people
out that
like to
Python
be.
was wrong. People do want the Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah, they were fascinated by it.
I was just thinking as well, people like to include sometimes in their travel accounts examples of kind of having di heated discussions with Catholic priests, for example, and besting them in an argument. Thinking as well of Olaudah Equiano, who's formerly enslaved, but after his manumission travelled again in the 1770s as a servant, and he talks about kind of having these heated discussions as a Protestant with a local Catholic priest who was saying, you'll get a scholarship to the University of Salamanca, and I can promise you all of these things. And he was able to kind of show that he had remained steadfast in his Protestantism.
We could do a whole episode, frankly, just on that. In fact, maybe we will, but we'll park that idea for another time, and stick to the main idea of the show. And I suppose we should get back to the list of questions, because we're like half an hour in. We still have only done question one. And there was something that you touched on, I believe it was Richard, you touched on earlier about why people were inclined to travel to this region pre-war, which I think is an important context to, A, what changes, but also why there might be an inclination to explore this region and why that might kind of explode outwards. So I guess the simple question really is, given it's so far from the Grand Tour and that route sort of down towards Italy, why are people going to Spain if it's not deemed, inverted commas, fashionable? Is it the fact that actually it's not fashionable that makes it part of the draw?
Well, to a certain extent, I think, but certainly people who go to Spain because, as they say, we don't know very much about it. And Johnson's friend, Joseph or Giuseppe Baretti, who was one of the early travellers that we're looking at, and he went to Spain in 1760. And Johnson was very keen that he should publish his travels because we know so little about Spain. and we need to know more. So there is a sense that it is much less well known than Italy. So if you're a writer of travels, that might be an attraction, because the market for travel literature on Italy is somewhat saturated, particularly in the later 18th century. So travel to Spain is something distinctive. It is off the main itinerary through France down to Italy, but if you can also approach Italy through the Straits of Gibraltar, which people do. So Spain is a stopping off point, and it's really not so far if you're sailing from Genoa, for example, or any of the ports on the northwestern seaboard of Italy, just round to Barcelona, which a number of people do. So you can visit Spain on your way back from Italy or on your way to Italy if you want. So there's a sense that there is a sense that it's unknown and therefore potentially more interesting. There's also a sense that Spain is a country that actually we need to know something about. And that's, I think, one of the key drivers for a lot of people going to Spain, that they're aware that it's a country that was hugely powerful in the early modern period and has immense resources and has this huge empire, which could potentially rival, well, not, I mean, has a very real, could easily rival Britain. And that Spain might actually get its act together. And there's this sense throughout the 18th century that Spain could actually recover and become a potent power in European politics again, and in global politics as well. And the enlightened reforms that are being introduced under Carlos III in particular actually give credence to this idea. And so there is a real interest in finding out more about Spain. But there's also interest in visiting Spain because it is a country that actually does have quite a lot of imaginative resonance in 18th century Britain. And we've talked about the Black Legend, we've talked about the popularity of Spanish medieval romances and the Spanish drama. But the key text that absolutely everybody had read was Don Quixote. Everybody traveled to Spain wanting to encounter Don Quixote and to see the windmills and to see the Sancho Panza's figures and Dulcinea and Toboso. So if you go to Italy in search of the landscape of Horace, you go to Italy, so Spain, in search of the landscape of Cervantes and Don Quixote. And that was, so there is a sense of recognition, which I think is one of the very powerful motive for travel, that people want to see places that they have an imaginative connection to through education or through reading. And that Spain does feature very strongly. And it's, in terms of its history, people are so aware of the closeness of British relations with Spain and with Portugal through the medieval and early modern period, whether it's Catherine of Braganza marrying Charles II, whether it's Catherine of Aragon marrying Arthur and then Henry VIII, and the Spanish marriage with Charles tripping off there with Buckingham, and then the wars in which the countries have been involved with. The Seven Years' War is quite a recent memory, not Seven Years' War, but the War of the Spanish Succession is quite a recent memory. Seven Years' War in Menorca, very recent memory. So Spain is a country that has a major imaginative presence for the British, and that's part of the draw.
Yeah, and I think it's worth highlighting a particular decade, the 1770s, a time when a lot of things changed to do with British travel to Spain in ways that really inform travel by soldiers and by civilians during the Peninsular War, because it's a time of peace between Britain and Spain before Spanish entry into the American War of Independence. But it's also a decade where British travel to continental Europe is expanding generally, and Spain, travel to Spain is part of that. And we find a real kind of concentration of a lot of travel writing by people like Henry Swinburne, Richard Twiss, which are extremely successful books that probably for the first time to a relatively broad British readership present kind of Spain and its attractions to the traveller. and kind of create the kind of things that people want to go and see there. Henry Swinburne, for example, is the first British writer to talk at length and illustrate frequently the Alhambra in Granada, the palace of the kind of Muslim emirs of Granada. So that's a particularly important decade, but it's also one that kind of produces a lot of the reading material that people who might have been traveling during the Peninsular War might have, kind of would have grown up having available to them. So it's a bit of a kind of step change in British travel to Spain, I think.
And I think that helps create another motive, which is a sense that Spain is different from the rest of Europe because of its Islamic heritage. And Swinburne obviously provides the most detailed description to date of the Alhambra. So knowledge of the Granada and the Alhambra spreads, and these are the sections that are reproduced in periodicals. So we know like contemporary book reviews, periodicals, they just extract sections from the publication. And it's always the sections on the Alhambra and Spanish women. And this helps create this idea of Spain as somewhere exotic, which I think was much less pronounced prior to that period. I mean, people knew in theory about it, but there's a much more tangible sense of Spain as somewhere exotic and on the margins between Africa and the East and the civilization of Europe and the in Andalusia in particular, this is where you can encounter it. So you quite often, Spain is hugely rich in Roman antiquities, obviously, Greek antiquities, Carthaginian. And people go to sites like Italica or Saguntum or Merida, where these are all preserved, but they're not terribly excited by them. It's not like visiting the Forum or the Colosseum or going to Pompeii. They're a bit. It's provincial Roman. They're not that interested. And also, Spain doesn't have the infrastructure of guides, etc., that you have initially to promote them. But what they're excited about is to see the Islamic heritage, because you can see Roman antiquities in Italy. You can't see that Islamic heritage. And that's it's who wants to go and traipse around rather presented, if you like. Roman antiquities, we're just going, what is it? When you can go to Granada and the Alhambra, and that becomes a real attraction. And again, in terms of imaginative presence, I think the key thing about the Alhambra is that practically every traveller who talks about it in terms of the Arabian Nights. This is the Arabian Nights is something that everybody seems to have read when they were a child. And so going to Granada and seeing the Alhambra, it's like seeing your childhood imaginations brought to life. So that's enormously exciting for people. And that becomes a bit hackneyed the way they talk about it, but fairyland, enchanted, place of genies, it's whimsical, exotic. It's they love it. And it's the alterity, the difference, and the fact that it's associated with this sort of nostalgic memory of being transported in your imagination by the Arabian Nights as a child, and then you're transported when you visit the Alhambra as an adult.
Yeah, and just quickly, I think thinking about obviously the Alhambra and the attractions of the Islamic history of Spain is something that particularly concentrates tourist attention on the south, obviously in Andalusia. And it's worth picking up there, I suppose, in the context of thinking particular about military travel, that quite a lot of people, officers based in British Gibraltar, are able to do small kind of tours around the south of Spain, especially in the second half of the 18th century. One of the writers who publishes in the 1770s, William Dalrymple, for example, is exactly an example of someone who gets a bit of leave from Gibraltar and decides to visit the sites of southern Spain.
Or James
So
Moore
there's
Molyneux.
mili so there's military travel going on well before the Peninsular War within the Spanish South.
I'm slightly embarrassed that actually the Gibraltar connection hadn't occurred to me. That's appalling. But there's usually a point in every episode where I humiliate myself with my lack of sort of wider contextual thinking, and it looks as though we've found that point for this one. Yeah, that's a glaring omission from me. and a lack of realization. Let us skate swiftly over that and talk about sort of the 1807, 1808. I don't know if there is a shift, and this is part of why I'm so interested in your research, because I had my sort of waffly outline of my thoughts and what I'm sort of trying to grapple with, and that sort of that sense of xenophobia that is there, certainly amongst the British rank and file. And some of that doesn't surprise me because, of course, the British are going to think that they're better than everyone else, because every nationality is in that sort of phase where they're starting to think, well, we're better just by being us. And we don't know what us constitutes, because national identity is still something that has a almost half a century, if not more, to run in terms of how it's formulated. But that sense of we're just better, whether it's the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese, there's a them and there's us, and what we represent is better. And that comes out very clearly in 1808 when troops start to land. But in that sort of feels very much at odds with what you've found in terms of the way in which certain people are talking about the landscape and the people. And so I'm just curious about whether there's a shift in the conversation when you get to the war. Because in one respect, if you look at things like the caricatures, they tap into a lot of this romanticization that you've been talking about already, and a lot of those kind of those tropes. And yet troops kind of get boots on the ground, and suddenly the stories that are going back are different in nature, partly because the context is different. And I'm just curious about how the attitude shifts, if at all, with that kind of almost explosion of exposure, I guess, and therefore that much greater diversity of responses to what people are seeing out in Spain, because there are just more people out in Spain who are prepared to write this down.
Well, as you've already hinted, there's a lot of excitement in the first half of 1808 that the Spanish patriots are going to liberate their country, and it's going to be so exciting to see this happen. And so pavilions go out there without expectation, or some of them do. And generally, they're disappointed. And I think there's quite a lot of common feeling. Well, not least because they mix a lot with the British officers. There's a very porous boundary between civilian and military society. So they would be informed by the scathing contempt that the British military had for Spain, particularly after episodes like Talavera, where they felt that the British had been completely sold down river by the Spanish with a failure to provide supplies, etc. And I think one thing is that the experience of British officers and the British rank and file is rather more primitive. They're being billeted and all over Spain and pretty and Portugal in pretty god awful conditions very often, and very primitive conditions. So that is inevitably going to give rise to more emphasis on the dirt, the filth, the poverty, the ungraciousness. And you have lots of complaints about how ungrateful the Spanish or the Portuguese are for the British because they aren't surrendering everything to them. Quite interesting seeing some of the civilian comments. I mean, Henry Holland, who was a physician, he went out to get experience, but he wasn't actually with the army. And he was appalled by the behaviour of the British and the arrogance. And he's saying, well, if people came to Britain and demanded that we gave up our houses to them, I don't think we would take it lying down. So why should the Spanish? And a number of other civilians observers actually are sufficiently detached to see that it's British arrogance that is provoking the Spanish, well, particularly the Spanish, and that if they weren't so inconsiderate, the way in which they completely disregard Spanish religious sensibility, for example, and the way in which they disregard private property and just take whatever they want, and their brutality. The French are brutal, but the British are brutal as well. And so some of these civilian observers have got quite a sharp eye for that and can actually take a more detached view. But yeah, in general, the view of the Spanish is that they're hopeless allies, and they're a And that, I mean, they're very much aware that many of the Spanish elite are negotiating with the French at the same time, and that's they don't have much respect for that. And again, they emphasize that the Spanish could be a more effective fighting force, that the Spanish peasants could be very effective soldiers if they had better command. So it's always the problem is of the elite. Interestingly, and I think this comes out in some of the military memoirs as well, because the Portuguese are more amenable to British bossing around, bullying, however you want to phrase it, and because Beresford's allowed to, a kind of free hand in reforming the Portuguese army, that the Portuguese come out of it better, I think, than the Spanish, that they start talking in much more positive terms than the Portuguese and comparing the Portuguese more favorably to the Spanish. Whereas in the 18th century, I think Robert Southey is the only person we've come across who actually prefers the Portuguese to the Spanish prior to the Peninsular War. So there is that shift. I
And in
think,
specific circumstances, because he stayed with his uncle in Portugal for a long time, didn't he?
And got to know Portugal much better and then went to Spain. Went, ooh, I don't like it. But yeah, in general, as we said, generally the Portuguese are seen as inferior, dirtier, less pleasant. But the Peninsular War was a more positive evaluation of them. And yeah, and they are compared favorably with the Spanish.
Yeah, I think with regard to the kind of optimism and pessimism, perhaps creeping pessimism of British views as well, one of the certainly with regard to civilian travellers, it's very clear, and of course military as well, it's very clear that the kind of the course of the war is something that is affecting people's attitudes quite strongly, and certainly some of the civilian travellers who we've seen, a lot of people. Come out in for the winter of 1808-9, and they seem to have been motivated to travel by things like the Great Spanish Victory at Bailen in July 1808, and the optimism, as Rowie was mentioning, that the Spanish may be able to throw off this kind of dual yoke, not just of the French, but perhaps of the Catholic Church and absolutism as well, so triple, I suppose. But because they've been motivated by Bailen to come out in the autumn and winter of 1808-9, they're actually there for some of the most difficult months of the war from a kind of Spanish and British perspective.
The Ocaña really seals it. They just think, oh, Spanish are hopeless.
So we see that in particular in some of the travellers like William Gell, who we've done a lot of work on. Who's very excited and thinking that it's the perfect time to go, but actually, when he's there, it's precisely when Napoleon is rolling back the Spanish gain.
And Henry Galley Knight, who actually goes out 1809, autumn of 18th August to January 1809, and he's sort of full of it, comes out with Lord Wellesley, full of excitement, and then just you can almost hear his jaw dropping at the sort of defeat of Ocaña. And he writes a poem, Iberia's Crisis, which is it's terrible, but it's all full of oh, hope for Spain and the potential of Spain, Spanish patriots. And then if you look at his diary and what he's writing to his friends, just saying the Spanish are completely degenerate, it's hopeless, they'll never win. Napoleon's going to take over all of France. It's not all of France, all of Spain. It's practically over. So there's this when he's writing a poem for wide consumption. So he's got to appeal to the wider British public sentiment and enthusiasm for Spanish war. But in private, he's scathing.
You've tapped into another one of my sort of pet topics there about that distinction between what's produced for a mass market and to what extent does that drive public opinion? Is it feeding off of it and all the rest of it? But we don't have time for that. So that's a third episode that we can maybe look forward to in the future. I want to take it back to something that you were talking about earlier in terms of the way in which the British civilian can actually see what the British officers are doing in its much kind of more what's the word I'm looking for? In a kind of a much colder light and a much more honest light. And I'm particularly struck by not only the brutality That, and I wonder to what extent is that sort of part of a growing culture within the army? Is that sort of a kind of an inverted commas macho attitude of, we're going to swagger in and, the British officer is going to grab the peasant by the ear and go, look, this isn't good enough. I want you to sweep my bedroom and all the rest of it, and I'm going to sort of treat you like a peasant. But also there's that process of making, which for folks who aren't familiar, making is basically a common practice amongst British officers, where they would just pick up little trinkets that they saw along the way, whether it's a nice set of silver spoons or whether it's a set of music from, their guest library or whatever it might be. There was this perception that anything that was left lying around in Spain and Portugal was basically open season for British officers to gather together. And then they would have these kind of contests of, look what I found. And when some individuals are writing back home, and Le Mesurier really springs to mind as an example of this, he's explaining about how post, I believe it was Badajoz, he picks up a set of plays. And he's boasting about this in a letter back to his family. And we don't have the reply from the family, but we have his subsequent reply back to his family, where he goes, no, you don't understand. This is what happens out in Spain. And clearly, his family have come back to him and gone, what the hell are you doing? Why are you walking into somebody's house and just helping yourself to stuff? And I think it's really interesting that we have this disconnect between what those who are embedded and utterly immersed in this conflict zone think is okay versus the popular perception. Is there much evidence of that interplay? Because I think that is something that really needs a lot of unpicking in terms of those conversations between those in the midst of it who can't see the wood for the trees and those back home who are looking at this from a more typical British society perspective, and the way in which one feeds into the other. Do we have much evidence of that?
I wouldn't say we do. I certainly can't think of any examples of civilian travellers commenting on this
Maybe
practice. And they
Hong Kong
comment,
potentially, but sorry, go on.
yeah. I mean, of the approach, I mean, they tend to talk much more of a French looting rather than English British looting. And they're appalled by the level of French looting. But again, that's part of the broader rhetoric of anti-Gallicans, anti-French. It's really the physical cruelty, I think, and the brutality. I can't think of any examples of them complaining about or disapproving of this practice of appropriating
I think
objects and possessions or.
one slightly related example, I suppose, might be the kind of quite common practice that we've seen, especially in Rory's work, actually, of British civilian travellers wearing uniforms in order, whether from the kind of the militia at home or borrowing a uniform in order to be able to kind of requisition horses
Yeah,
and accommodation from
but
the
that's more a
population.
pragmatic way of getting
Sure.
around Spain rather than
But Thomas Traill doesn't want to do that, does he? He has reservations
no,
about going
he
on.
thought that was just dishonest.
Yeah.
But I mean, most a lot of the English travellers who went to Spain obviously served in the militia at home because that's what most landed wealthy men did. And they were advised to take out their militia uniforms and to put them on because then you can pass as an army officer, which means that you can requisition horses, you can demand billets, you will be able to pass through Spain through military areas without getting stopped. Henry Holland, who I just mentioned, he doesn't belong to the militia and he doesn't have a militia uniform, and when he's in Portugal he wants to go and up country into Spain to see the army and to see the military hospitals because that's what he's interested in. And he's told, no, you can't do that because all the resources are to be used for the army. You won't be able to get a horse and you won't be able to get a billet. Whereas if he'd had his militia uniform, he could have just put it on and gone, swanned off and pretended he was whatever. And he would have been able to travel. So it actually, that was one of the ways in which travel could be facilitated. Is that you pass yourself off as a member of the army. But it had its downsides as well.
I think we will get to that because there's immediately a question about status, and parading around in your militia uniform might be fine when you're back home and you're not likely to come across regular officers of the line, but you get some pretty scathing comments, even about newbies going out, let alone militia officers kind of going around and parading around in their uniforms. So we'll come back to that in just a second. That was Professor Rosemary Sweet and Dr. Richard Ansell, who will be returning in a second instalment. A reminder that you can find Rosemary's book, Cities and the Grand Tour, The British in Italy, 1690 to 1820, at Cambridge University Press's website. There's a link in the description. And Roger's book, Complete Gentlemen, Educational Travel and Family Strategy, 1650 to 1750, was published by the British Academy. And again, there's a link in the description. Stay tuned, because in a few days they will be returning in order to continue this fascinating discussion about Peninsular War tourism. If you'd like to enjoy their research in more detail, you can join the Napoleonic and Revolutionary War Graves Charity. Yes, I know, folks, hashtag ad, hashtag shameless plug, but they will be doing a talk this month, which is free for members of the charity and £5 for non-members. So if you're interested, again, there is a link in the description, and please do come along. We would love to see you there. Remember to leave a 5-star review of the podcast. And have a fantastic day.
Folks, you know the drill by now. If you're new here, remember to hit that subscribe button so that you can find your way back. And if you're loving the show, remember to leave a review. It makes a vast amount of difference in terms of helping this show to reach a wider audience. Much love to all of my Patreon supporters who hopefully are going to start enjoying some slightly different elements of the perk package. Shout outs to my mentioned in dispatches patrons, Rob Griffith, Brendan Teeling, Beatrice de Graaf, Lynn Dawson, Lucy Tattner, Jim Deary, Josh Keeney, Colin Fieldhouse, Stephen Colson, Jim Getz, Stephen Gillen, Hugh Brennan, Alistair Campbell-Grieve, Andy Meakin, Mark Anscombe, Rob Coughlin, Bruins Girl, Noah Fink, Mark Trowbridge, Miles Reedy, Nick Overland, Graham Goodwin, Chris Pramus, Anthony Gumbau, Anonymous American, Martin Pisani, Auric Ducado, James Fluick, Roger O'Donnell, Natasha Hobday, Rod Schwager, Chris Kimball, Gary Dennis, David Graylick, Ted Andrews, David Milinski, Richard Anderson, Arthur Forgy, Sam Moore, Wyatt Pollock, Carol Dixon Smith, Roland Shark, Jason Moran, and Mark Chestnut. And the Admirals, John Haynes, Ryan Diamond, JC Kaiser, Bob Burnham, Mike Guest, Liam Telfer, Todd and Led Campbell, Graham Swidenbank, Rachel Stark, Mark Duckers, David Maxwell, David Priest, Graham Callister, Sean Sullivan, Stephen Ashworth, Dan Hazelwood, Kate Walcombe, Steve Carter, Clemens Bemmon, Charles McKay, Reto the Sci-Fi Fan, and Tim Day. I'll be back very soon, but until then, I'm Zach White. This has been the Napoleonic Wars Pod. Take care of yourselves, my friends. Stay well. Stay safe. And as always, thank you for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more. Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.